Good afternoon, everybody. We'd like to kick off our third and final subcommittee of the Game and Fish Subcommittee in this session. Today, what we're planning on doing is putting together our omnibus bill that we'll next pass on to the full Energy and Environment Committee for their consideration. On Tuesday, and I'm sorry I missed some of the testimony here, we had a number of bills presented and laid over for consideration in inclusion of the omnibus bill today. We're going to start off with hearing Senate File 2606 regarding muskie fishing modifications, and then work through a second bill on quail recovery plans, and then pull up the individual bills and add them to our omnibus bill 2227. I don't anticipate we'll have a whole lot of time here today, but if anyone would like to speak to any of the bills or the issues before us today, we'll be sure to give you a chance to do that. Senator Hoffman actually is not able to join us today. He has a conflict, so Senator Eaton's going to sit in his place regarding the issue of Senate File 2606. So, members, that's before us right now. And folks who'd like to testify in favor of 2606, if you could please prepare yourselves. And, of course, those who'd like to speak against it. So with that said, Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to introduce the bill of we're going to increase the muskie size to 55 inches is, I believe, the point of this bill. And I'm hoping that we have somebody to testify as to why.
All right.
Sorry.
That's great. And do we have testimony here in favor of this bill that Senator Hoffman had introduced? All right. Sure, sir. If you're ready, please join us. And if you would state your name for the record, please, and proceed as you like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Underhill, Minnesota Muskie and Pike Alliance. We've been concerned about the sustainability of the trophy muskie in Minnesota. It has become extremely popular. The estimated anglers were 31,000 in 2001 through the electronic ELS system that the DNR has, and now University of Minnesota estimates the number at 111,000. It's generated a lot of interest. It's put a lot of additional pressure on the fishery. There has been no in doubling, almost quadrupling the number of fishermen. There hasn't been a doubling of stocking or even adding or doubling the number of available lakes. So we're compressed into the range that we have. And it's definitely shown to have some sort of impact on the fish. We're not... The guides on the bigger bodies of water are not catching the big 50-inch plus fish like they were in the mid-2000s, 2005, 2007. We're seeing a lot of those businesses moving to smaller lakes, and now many of them are heading out to Lake St. Clair or Green Bay and not spending as much time or any time in Minnesota. There's been a lot of research done in Canada on sustaining muskie populations and the value of large fish. If Muskies Inc. members, they harvest probably 1% or less of the fish they catch, and the non-Muskies Inc. members, that nobody really knows for sure, but it could be up to 10%, maybe more. We just don't know exactly. And then doubling the number of anglers, you're seeing more of those fish being taken out as trophies at 50 and 51, 52, 53 inches. So it's been a concern of ours that we've voiced for for many years now with the DNR. The DNR has done good research as well. Their papers show that muskies can readily reach the 55-inch range in Minnesota lakes. They didn't have a large sampling back when they did that of the a lot of lakes, but now we look and it's coming from big lakes, small lakes, lakes from the Minnesota-Iowa border all the way up to Lake of the Woods and Lake Vermilion, where these fish are reaching 55 and exceeding 58, 59 inches. There's some big fish that are out there, and every time we lose one of those 53 and 54s, it's nearly impossible to just replace that fish. That fish just doesn't come back into the system. And that's what's getting people to come back to Minnesota from all over the world. The guides in Minnesota have got people coming from the Soviet Union, Finland, Italy. They're flying in from everywhere just to fish muskies in Minnesota because they know how what we've got here and how fantastic it is. And our concern is sustaining that and keeping the young people involved and growing the sport as much as we possibly can. There's been a lot of good things that have came about with the growth of muskie fishing. The economic factor, the University of Minnesota, David Fulton did a study with just expenditures, not economic impact, but just expenditures were about $90 million. A Longville real estate broker sent us some information from that area, and he said that there's definitely a higher value in, even though they're comparable lakes up there, lakes that have muskies, property values are higher, and the homes sell faster. And they've seen in the Alexandria area, right on their visitors page, it's their tourism page, it's come and catch a 10-pound walleye and a 50-pound muskie. I mean, it's gotten bigger than just guys going out and catching a fish or two or beating the water for 10,000 casts. There's Lake Vermilion about 5 years ago. The headline in the Star Tribune for the sports page was the muskie opener was bigger than the walleye opener, which is amazing. I mean, I can't even hardly imagine, but when you go out and you fish and you pay attention to who's on the water with you, you get to see that this is becoming a big deal, and it has been a big deal for a long time. So we are concerned, and I've got some information. I think there was enough for all of you to see it on some of the stuff that is our concerns with sustaining the fishery. The fish over 50 inches, over 48 inches, their value to the state and to the anglers is more than just in recruitment or spawning. That is very important, especially on the natural lakes where it does occur. Minnesota DNR, I've been out with them, and when they take eggs from a fish, they take them from the largest fish. I believe it was 2009, they got 600,000 eggs from a 53-inch female. So the reproductive quality doesn't necessarily drop off like some believe after they reach a certain size. The big fish, 50-plus inch, that's what people are coming here for. That's what's made Minnesota muskie fishing famous. We're seeing those large fish depleting and disappearing, and that's our concern.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Underhill. We appreciate that perspective, and you spoke eloquently there, so thank you for your testimony. You're welcome to stay at the witness table. At this time, are there any questions among committee members? If not, please stay there, and I'd invite anyone else in the audience who'd like to speak to this bill. Again, Senate File 2606. Please take the stand. Hello, sir. If you could state your name for the record, please.
Certainly. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Tim Spreck. I am the president of the Minnesota Dark House and Angling Association. And we have some alternative positions with regard to the 55-inch muskie that I'd like to go bring to your attention this afternoon. There's a few things that I want to make you aware of as a preliminary list of facts that will become important as I continue my testimony. But currently, 35% of Minnesota's waters are managed for muskie. That's roughly 790,000 acres statewide. Includes 54 additional waters where muskie are not managed but have either occurred there due to previous management or traditionally have been there. The cost to stock muskie is about $785,000 per year, and muskie do migrate rather readily from lake to lake through river systems, etc. The proposed change to a 55-inch muskie ensures virtually that no harvest will ever take place. Muskie seldom achieve a size over 55 inches. We understand that, you know, they do get up above that number, but traditionally you're looking at very large females, and 55 is just about the max. Currently, there's also no winter muskie fishing season. So if we go to 55 inches during the summer season, that virtually ensures no harvest of any kind. Muskie is going to become catch and release. Continued stocking without harvest can lead to problems because, as we discovered earlier, at $785,000 a year, we continue to stock. There's nothing coming out of the system on the back end, so what you're going to end up with is a glut of large muskie in these lakes. And as an example, think of what's happened on Lake Mille Lacs. That lake has been managed for a number of years for large predatory species, and now we've got an absolute collapse there because we've had nothing but large protected species eating small fish. You've had a collapse of perch, tulipy, and now we're witnessing the walleye disappearing. So we have to be very careful about what we put into law, folks, because what we do today can reap serious problems down the line. Proposed change is unprecedented in the United States. Michigan has a minimum harvest size of 42 inches. Wisconsin has a minimum harvest size of 40 inches. If we go to a 55-inch minimum for muskie, we will be setting a precedent nationwide. 55-inch ensures no harvest, and continued stocking amplifies the population growth. Now for the reason why the Dark House Association is particularly concerned about a 55-inch muskie. Muskie compete directly with the pike, and that's our target species. They compete directly for food and for habitat. As the larger of the two, the muskie generally emerges as a top predator. Increasing the average size of muskie can make this problem worse because it essentially takes the competition and puts it in the favor of the muskie versus the northern pike. So we have to be very careful about upsetting the balance that we have in a lot of these lakes. No harvest also can discriminate against food fishermen and trophy hunters. The Dark House Association has traditionally spoken for the blue collar, the hardworking men and women of the state of Minnesota that are putting food on the table through the harvest of fish. We're not an elite group. We're a group of hardworking folks. And for us, when we buy a license, we would like to have at least a reasonable opportunity of being able to put a fish on the table to eat. If you take the muskie off the plate, that's an opportunity that's been lost for these folks that are feeding their families. No harvest removes that right and caters only to the elite sport fishermen, as Mr. Underhill spoke about earlier. We believe that there's a place for everybody at the table in Minnesota's lakes, but we have to make sure that the little guy and the people that are putting food on the table are not boxed out of the equation. This is also detrimental to recruitment and retention. If you take your son, daughter, grandson, granddaughter out on the lake and they hook into a 49-inch muskie, a 50-inch muskie, for that person, that may be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that they may never repeat again. And if that fish if they're forced to put that fish back into the lake, they lose that opportunity. And I think kids really want to be able to take a fish home, experience cleaning it with their folks, experience filleting it, experience cooking it, and experience eating it. So those opportunities are going to be lost. Let's stay with the current 48-inch minimum. It was just changed only a couple years ago, and now 48 is the largest in the country. 55 is absolutely unprecedented, unnecessary. So let's provide opportunity for everyone and make sure that we have a fishery that's sustainable and doesn't end up with nothing but large predators in the waters. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Spreck. Are there any questions among committee members at this stage? Otherwise, I'd like to call DNR up to the stand to speak to this bill. Thank you. And, sir, if you could state your name for the record, please.
For the record, I am Don Pereira. I'm chief of fisheries for the section of fisheries for the Minnesota DNR. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to provide some testimony on this bill. For the record, the DNR is actually neutral on this bill, but I think I'll be able to provide some information that might help with your deliberations when you consider the bill. First of all, to state the obvious, you know, the DNR has recognized that muskellunge is basically a trophy fish. In fact, we have a lot of trophy opportunities around the state for many fish species, but at the pinnacle of that trophy fishery is certainly in the muskellunge. So, you know, we support the general notion that sustainability in the sense of a quality trophy fishery means conserving relatively small numbers of large fish. So in that regard, we're neutral on the bill. However, I do want to just present to you our history on muskellunge management and also some of the things that we have in place right now. First of all, if you look at the history of our regulations, as it was just alluded to, over time they've been increasing our statewide minimum. And we feel that this is important for supporting a freely limited trophy fishery. You know, for example, you know, northern pike is very important sport fish, especially for consumption, and we manage northern pike in maybe about 2,000 lakes statewide. Muskellunge, in comparison, we maybe have about 60 prime lakes for musky fishing. So I think there's plenty of room for managing northern pike for harvest, managing muskellunge for trophy management. In our rule package this year, we are currently at 40 inches statewide. In our rule package that's in for public review right now, we are proposing to go to 50 inch statewide. Now, our analysis indicates that not every musky lake in the state can support has the growth to actually produce a fish that would actually reach 55 or 56 inches, but there's certainly some of them that do produce fish that large, and some of them have been mentioned. Mille Lacs is one, Lake Vermilion is one, Lake Bemidji. There's about 15 that we know for sure that are capable of producing truly spectacular fish. So what we also have in place is basically a two-tiered management approach. Through our special and experimental regulations program that's been in place for a long time, our local managers will be able to identify one or more of these lakes in their management areas that they think truly are potentially spectacular for trophy muskellunge, and then we will actually propose through our special experimental regulation process a 56-inch minimum for those lakes. So our concern with 55 inches across the board for all lakes is that on some lakes it's going to be overkill because they just don't have the potential to produce fish that big. So in regards to sustainability, yeah, big fish do produce a lot of eggs. Smaller fish produce plenty of eggs as well. In fact, you know, in some of our sport fish populations, our feeling is that, you know, egg viability or whatever could be prime maybe for fish small in that, kind of like it's like comparing you know, human fertility for females that are 30 years old versus in their 40s or whatever. It's a very, very similar concept to that. So there could be some senescence that happens with really, really large fish. They still produce a lot of eggs, but performance, you know, could be questionable. We're not sure about that. That's not backed up by research, but it's just based on our fundamental understanding of how senescence could happen in older fish populations. So,
well, thank you, Mr. Ferreira. Senator Brown, you have a question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Pereira, would this legislation take away your ability to have the two-tier approach?
Well, it would remove the need for the two-tier approach because it would put 55 inches statewide, and considering a lake for 56 wouldn't, I mean, that wouldn't be worth the trouble to add an additional inch to that. So, yeah, it would make the two-tier approach not of much utility at all, I think.
Sir Osmick.
Mr. Chair, are we voting on this one, or we're not laying anything over anymore? We have to decide what's in and what's out here.
Today is the moment of decision. So yeah, we will be planning on voting on each of these and putting them into the omnibus bill.
Right.
So, any other questions? All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Ferreira.
Thank you.
And I think at this stage in the game, we're going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion, and we may come back to this towards the end of the committee. So I thank you, Senator Eaton, and thank you, Mr. Underhill.
Thank you.
All right. And moving next, we'd like to get into to Senate File 2531, if we could. And this is a bill that I had introduced. And we do have a testifier here today, I do believe, Mr. Thurman Tucker, if you could take the stand if you're here. And we do have an A1 amendment for the for this bill that's coming around to you right now. And Mr. Knopf, if you don't mind just walking us through the A1 real quick for our consideration.
Mr. Chair, the A1 is just a little lighter bill than the original. It basically, instead of the original one, talked about a detailed plan for recovery. And this talks about a detailed feasibility study. It's kind of more the initial step. And there was also some language about why we're doing this, and you don't really need to have for its ecological, recreational, economic benefits. My understanding is some DNR staff were having some concerns with trying to meet standards, and it really is more than, and they're just to explain why you're doing it and to ask the DNR to do this. I think we all know why we would like the quail return.
Well, thank you, Mr. Knopf. You know, do I have a? I'd like to work off of the A1 amendment. Do I have a motion to amend the Senate file? Senator Brown moves adoption of the A1 amendment. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment's adopted. And with that said, Mr. Tucker, if you're able to proceed and provide a little bit of background for this this bill and your views on quail hunting, and please proceed.
Okay. Mr. Chair and committee members, thanks for allowing me being here and all.
And, sir, if you could just state your name for the record.
Sorry. Thurman Tucker. I'm with Quail Forever. I'm a coordinator. We have two chapters here in the state, one here in the metro area and one here in southeastern Minnesota. Our sole purpose is really to increase the quail numbers here in Minnesota. Honestly, I'm pleasantly surprised that Representative Henson brought this up. I read it in the paper and all, and I was just surprised because I've worked with the DNR for years, and I might add that we pretty much work independent of any state or federal agencies. We just get out and try to do the work. Our main goal really is to increase the habitat with youth involvement. And we know what it takes to for a good quail habitat, and we're out there doing it. I think the big question is, though, do we have quail in Minnesota? And that's the DNR's concern. Now, I've been working with quail for, oh, my goodness, 35, 40 years almost, long, long time here in Minnesota. And we'll acknowledge that we do not have a huge population. It never really has been that great, but we do have quail here in the state. They are native to this area. And I just want to read some numbers here, and I've been keeping track here for years, but in the last 7 years, so to speak, I thought I would just kind of keep some records of people who report to me of seeing bobwhite or hearing bobwhite quail here in the state of Minnesota. We started out on a chapter in 2005, and so I thought, well, we'd just start from there. But 2006, we have 8 sightings that were reported to me, and these birds were whistling or the birds were seen. 2007, we had 11 birds. 2008, we had 22 sightings. Now, mind you, some of this increase, I think, is because people have become more aware that we're interested in bobwhite quail. Anyway, in 2009, we had 43 sightings. I want to add here, too, regarding these sightings here, we do have some brood sightings. 2007, these are young birds. 2007, we had 3 sightings of broods. 2008, we had 6 sightings of broods. 2009, we had 5 sightings of broods. Getting back over to 2010, we had 32 sightings reported to us, 2 brood sightings. 20, 2011, we had 21 sightings. We had 7 sightings of broods. 2012, we had 35 sightings. And that same year, we had 6 brood sightings. Last year, 2013, we had 50 sightings of bobwhite quail here in the state of Minnesota. We only had 2 sightings of broods. Now, we do have birds, and I've been, for years, I've been down, and I understand the DNR, you know, because I've talked to people who, like some of their people who do the pheasant research road counts during August. They have never reported, in the last 30 years, reported any quail sightings. They have a specific route they run, and they're not really looking for quail. But what I do personally, I go to farmers, landowners, and ask them. And I remember one case in particular, I went to a lady and asked, and I had to book and everything, showing what a bobwhite quail looks like, because I'd heard they'd been there and all. So I go up to this lady's house, this farmer's house, and, gee, you ever seen these birds around? What I had just witnessed myself before I pulled in there was a covey of quail that went underneath her corn crib. And I asked her, did she ever see them? She said, boy, I don't think so. You know, and they just ran underneath her corn crib. I went back, about a month or two later, and I demonstrated how they whistle. This is the way they sound when they whistle. And I went back, yeah, I hear that. And then all of a sudden I kept contact. Yeah, I'm seeing them now. It's just the thing is, she was not even aware the birds were there, and it's right there on her property, so to speak. So I can understand people saying, well, we don't have quail in Minnesota. And again, I understand the numbers are low. But what we have done, our 2 chapters here in the state, we've devised a way that we can really increase these birds. And one of the things we're working on, we just started off this year, and I have some copies here, too, I'd like to leave with anyone would like to see these. These are quail corn cribs that we just put out. Plenty of copies. I'll leave some for you to want to see those and everything. And what it is, it's just basically 2 pallets together with wire cylinders. We're using 4x4 wiring with the mesh, so to speak. And you can see, you're going to pass those out. Okay. Moving my little satchel over there, too. So you can see how they're constructed. But what they're designed to do, they're designed to be right back in the brush where quail like to hang out. So what we're doing now, we just started this winter, is putting these corn cribs out where quail can have access to them during the wintertime. That's the number one thing we're going to be doing. And then we started it this year. But what we have been doing already, there's a federal program called the CP33. That program is specifically targeted for bobwhite quail. Houston and Fillmore County here in the state are the only 2 states that really can get into that. And what we've done, we've signed up really about, we have roughly about 500 people that have enrolled, landowners that have enrolled into that, 500 acres, so to speak, that have enrolled into that program. This is a buffer program that all the states in the quail range, Missouri, Indiana, Georgia, North Carolina, Texas, all the states in the quail range are into this program. And they have found this program really works for quail. That's one of the reasons I think we're seeing our numbers come up, because we have roughly about 500 acres signed into that. After that, we just want to intensify the brush and then go in with the corn crib. So these 3 basic things that we're doing. I want to add, too, that what we do with high school students like in the Southeast, what I work with down there, we get the high schools like Caledonia, Spring Grove, Houston High School, La Crescent High School. They come out and we cut the brush. They help us to pile it in a fashion where it's going to be beneficial to quail. So we have kids coming right in helping us. So as we bring the bobwhite back, we want to have the children or the students right with us. So years to come, they're going to say, hey, I was a part of that effort of helping to bring those bobwhite back. No question, we do have the birds. We do have marginal habitat. We're trying to improve that habitat. I would welcome any time the DNR, like I said, we're very independent. We're not looking for money or whatever, but any time the DNR would like to work with us, we would be more than happy, or anybody else, you know, because we just want to see more of these birds out there. Missouri did a study in fact, they put out a questionnaire here about 3 years ago, passed out to all the landowners in the state of Missouri. All the different birds on there and animals, deer, pheasants, grouse, cardinals, blue jays, chickadees, had them all on there, bobwhite quail. They asked, of the species that you see on this list, and they had them all on there, which one would you like to have on your property? Bobwhite quail came up as number 1. That is a high-interest species, and I just think it would do Minnesota well to have those birds come up and that more people can enjoy them and all. But anyway, I'm more than happy to work with anybody. I got other materials we can pass out. for sightings and everything else. So, but anyway, that's basically about it, what I have. So we just want to see more quail around.
Very good. Well, thank you, Mr. Tucker. We appreciate your enthusiasm and in working with youth on this issue. And thanks a lot for your testimony here today. We understand we asked you to give the highlights, and you had much more to say in a presentation for us, too. So maybe we can talk down the road about that. With that said, are there any questions of Mr. Tucker here at this point? Otherwise, would DNR like to weigh in on this issue at all? If you'd like to, please take the stand. Otherwise, we would next move to any additional testimony. All right. Well, with that said, we'll move to lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill here yet today. And up next, we'd like to actually open up Senate File 2048. We have an amendment that we'd like to consider for Senate File 2048.
I thought we already did that last time.
Okay. Oh, is that right?
We already adopted it last time.
Okay. I'm sorry. Members, I apologize. That was actually adopted and put onto the bill last time in my absence on Tuesday. Yeah. All right. I apologize for that. And if that's not the case, we can fix it in full committee. So with that said, we'll open up Senate File 2227 and hear any additional testimony on the Omnibus Game and Fish Bill. With that said, if anyone would like to take the stand at this point to speak to Senate File 2227, please join us. And I do have Ms. Kim Dimmick. I understand that you were able to speak to us 2 days ago. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Yeah. And if you could just state your name for the record and proceed as you like.
Kimberly Dimmick, Hastings, Minnesota. We did testify Tuesday, and we have been working with the DNR to try and make some changes to the wording to make it better for everybody. I'm not sure at this point. I think we need to have them come up and let you know what the changes are that they want to make before we can really respond to that.
Okay. All right, so we have the A1 amendment, I understand, that we'd like to pass out to folks.
You don't have it yet. I don't think you have it yet.
Let's say that's got quail already all over.
Thank you, ma'am.
I haven't had anything to eat all day. I'm getting hungry.
That's not good.
All right, and when you like, you can proceed to discuss it.
Okay, I'm not sure what they're giving you, because as we were talking here, we were changing language, so I'm not sure what they just put in front of you.
What I'll
wording.
Do is I'll allow Mr. Knopf to run through the A1 amendment for us here.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment, and this was done a little bit earlier, we have had conversations since entering the room, instead of the way the DNR, this would be to replace Section 27 in the bill. There were some concerns that were brought up at the last subcommittee meeting about the language and whether or not some of these horse farms and other places where they have stockades and corrals where they would receive the same protection. And what this does is it would be in lieu of that. And currently this would still say may not discharge a firearm within 500 feet of a stockade or corral confining livestock. And it says for the purpose of normal livestock holding and sorting. The earlier version said commercial, and this would be just normal. So as long as you're not just putting out a pen just to stop people from shooting near it, it would work operations without permission of the owner, occupant, or lessee. And then there were some concerns by the DNR over how this affected public lands. And I guess there are still some concerns over private lands. But with this, with the new sentence after the period on line 1.11, would say is this paragraph does not apply to persons hunting during an established hunting season or when a person is on public land that is not a road right away. Now what that would do would open up private land for all hunting and then public land when you're not on a road right away, so that the restrictions wouldn't apply on discharging a firearm within 500 feet of a stockade or a corral. Now, in further discussions with the proponents at the witness table, there was some thought that to only apply that this year to public land, and that could easily be done by deleting a few words from the amendment to make it only apply to public land, and that was the I think the biggest concern that DNR brought up is when they have a wildlife management area and somebody has a corral nearby, what does that mean for somebody hunting on the wildlife management? Do they have to worry about the corral that's within 500 feet. So there was some discussion that I had with the witnesses about deleting everything after season on 1.12 and deleting is on 1.13. So then it would say this paragraph does not apply to persons hunting during an established hunting season on public land that is not a road right-of-way. So the restrictions would still apply to privately owned land, the 500 feet from the stockade or corral, but would not apply when you're on public land that is not a road right-of-way. And so that's basically where we're at.
So, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Osmond.
Just to sort of diagram this out, so you've got public land, private land, because that's really where the issue here is. The public land, people could go hunt on that land regardless of where the animals were in the stockade and anything else that's going on.
Mr. Chair, yep. Not under current law, they would be restricted even on the private land from hunting within 500 feet of a neighbor's stockade, unless they get permission.
Okay, Mr. Chair. So what we're saying here is that under this new provision, then I guess what we're trying to deal with is people putting up quick and easy places to stop you from hunting on public land. So this would really satisfy that.
This,
Mr. Knopf?
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmond, this would satisfy. This would take care of public hunting on public land.
Okay. Thank you.
And thank you, Mr. Knopf, for running us through that. I understand that there is an option for an additional oral amendment to this amendment.
I did just mention that it would be to delete everything after season on 1.12 and delete everything before just basically deleting the is on line 1.13. Mm-hmm. And then that, I think, would take care of what the witnesses are looking for, in my understanding.
Mr. Chair,
yes, that would keep our protection in place at this time. I know the DNR said they would look into the private land issue next year.
Sure.
Can I make a statement on that, too?
Ms. Dimmick, you absolutely may.
Okay. The concern that I was told by Rod today was somebody that bought or inherited land from family members that they originally hunted on. Somebody buying acreage next to them, bringing in livestock, and keeping them from hunting on that property. Keep in mind, 500 feet is 1 2/3 football field's length. Any property, say somebody has a hobby farm, 15 acres or less, or even 20 acres or less, that distance between hobby farms isn't a safe distance to fire a firearm at an animal anyway. If you look at it, you're in the rule, it says 500 feet. And I think that was probably put in there for a reason, for the distance that a bullet can travel. I don't know if you were there Tuesday when we discussed that in the email I sent out to everybody. I did put a website in there people could check on. So as I was sitting here thinking about what we were discussing, I don't think that 500-foot rule is bad for private property. The person with 40 acres that has it for hunting land, they still have plenty of land that they can hunt on off of that buffer area from the livestock. And keep in mind, this is for a corral of a size of 1 acre. This doesn't mean off a pasture fence. This means 500 feet from the buildings, the houses, the barns, or a corral the animals are kept in. And most people with livestock, if you come and tell them you're going to hunt, they'll pull their animals in to keep them safe while you're hunting and then replace them back anyway. And I don't think any private party is trying to keep, there's some, but not necessarily everybody is trying to keep people from hunting on their land. They're more concerned with keeping their animals safe. So that 500-foot rule, I think, for private property is feasible to me.
All right. Well, thank you, Ms. Dimmick. Would DNR like to weigh in on this bill and the amendment that we're considering before us? And deer hunters, too. All right. If you don't mind stating your name here for the record, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Rodman Smith, Assistant Director for DNR Enforcement. Mr. Chair, not to belabor this too much and give you too much detail and history here because I know we're compressed for time, but about seven years ago, there was no protection under the trespass statute for horses because they weren't considered livestock. And then there was some legislation through the Ag Committees that for other reasons not related to game and fish that made them livestock, which then they fell under this protection for game and fish. And then with that new definition, the law was changed with some constituent issues that happened, I believe, in the Duluth area, then I believe out west a little bit, where there were some people that had some horses and there were some neighbor disputes. So they made these law changes. And so these law changes for these couple constituents really had an impact on hundreds of thousands of hunters and a bunch of hunting land throughout the state when they made those changes. And so now the DNR is trying to come back and strike a balance between those folks that do own horses and those people that have the constitutional right to hunt and fish in the state of Minnesota, whether it's on public or private land. So the language that Mr. Knopf worked with, and we worked with the testifiers here today, solves half the problem. It solves the problem for those people that want to continue to exercise their constitutional right to hunt and fish on private land, or excuse me, on public land. But I think Mr. Knopf has already talked about, we still do need to address the rights of those people that do own private property and are able to continue to hunt on private property. So this gets us halfway there, and because of the compressed time schedule here with the legislative session, the department is happy, well, not happy, we agree to get this halfway fixed and then continue conversations with stakeholders and MDHA and any of the other folks and come back and fix the private land issue next year.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Smith. And if I could, I understand that we have a representative from the deer hunters who might want to join the table to speak to this as well. If you'd like to, sir, please join the table.
You mind?
Thank you.
And if you don't mind stating your name for the record, sir.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Corey Bennett representing the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. I guess I could sum it up by kind of ditto what the Lieutenant Colonel said. Certainly, we do support this first step, but we do think there's a larger issue out there that we need to deal with, which is the private land issue. This takes care of half of that with the public land issue. Certainly, I think this is going to take a larger discussion than one you have time for tonight, Mr. Chairman, and hopefully we can get this figured out over the summer so that we can bring something back next year that we can agree upon. But this private land issue with regards to hunting and yet taking care of livestock and the farming issues is complex, but I think there is some private land issues here that need to be addressed at some point. We'll work with all the interested parties this summer and hopefully come back with something. But I just wanted to be on the record, Mr. Chairman, that I think half the issue is taken care of.
Sure.
But the private hunting land issue is certainly an outstanding issue that we'll would like to see addressed next session.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Bennett. And I'd just like to say that I do encourage that dialogue to continue. I know that we had had this conversation in this very subcommittee last year, and we do hope to work towards resolution of this. And I just appreciate folks on, I guess, all sides of the issue sharing your concerns today. And I'll definitely, you know, promote, you know, positive dialogue and working with the department to figure this out for all stakeholders. So thank you for your testimony. If there's any other perspective that you'd like to offer, please. And if you could state your name for the record.
Pamela Jewison, and reiterating what everyone else said, this is not a fix-all. It gets the hunters hunting, and it protects horse owners and their horses for now. We do need to come back and look at private property owners and get a fix there, because I know there is private land that people like to hunt, and this is a step forward, and I'm glad that there was a conversation about that this year and that there's going to be steps taken to fix the problem, because my husband and lots of people I know hunt, so.
Very good. Well, thank you very much for your testimony here today and for coming back a second time in 1 week here to talk about this. We appreciate your commitment to this issue, and we'll continue to promote conversation around this. Now, getting back to the discussion, I believe we have an amendment to the amendments here, Mr. Knopf.
Well, Mr. Chair, whoever moves the amendment could just incorporate the change that I read earlier.
Very well.
It would just be deleting those words or when a person is, so that it would be clear that it's a person hunting on public land that is not a road right of way.
All right. With that said, Senator Eaton would move the A1 amendment per. As modified by Mr. Knopf. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
And those opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. And now before us, members, I think we are working our way through the list here. And I should mention, I know that there has been an ongoing discussion with Senate File 2067, and we have a couple of potential amendments out there. What I'd like to do is continue that dialogue, because I know that dialogue is live right now between DNR and those stakeholders. And so we don't plan on amending 2067 today in subcommittee, but this this bill, the omnibus Game and Fish Bill 2227, will be before the full committee next week, I anticipate. And I'm happy to continue to talk with stakeholders regarding this issue, and hopefully we can work out an agreement and we can consider amendment at that time. So that's how I'd like to proceed. And now, moving forward here, I believe that we've had an opportunity to hear two new bills today, 2606, 2531, and those have been laid on the table alongside 2067, 2048, 2137, and 2018. We do have an amendment in addition, the A2 amendment, to consider for Senate File 2227, and that will be handed out right now.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Osmick.
I'd actually like to consider adding the 2067. I understand that there's more conversation, but I think I would like to have us express that as a committee that 2067 should be in. I think before it goes to the next committee.
I'm sorry, Senator Osmick. You'd like that conversation to take place here today?
I want it in now. I would prefer to have it in now because I think it's a good thing.
So just to be clear, what I would propose doing is incorporating Senate File 2067 as currently written into the Omnibus Game and Fish Bill and moving that along to full committee. You're in agreement with that?
Yep.
All right. That's how we'll plan to proceed. Sorry if there was any confusion with that. So before us now, we have the A2 amendment to Senate File 2227. Mr. Knopf, if you'd mind just taking us through this real quick.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, what this does is it this doesn't look right.
It's not right.
This looks like it's the same language that's in the bill itself, and it was supposed to be different. And I'm not sure why it looks the same. There's a mistake. I'm sorry. We can just. We'll have to do that one in full committee. There was some discussion with the DNR. Senator Saxlock has a separate proposal on this same section of law, and for some reason when the amendment was being done, it was taken from the bill, this bill instead of the other bill. So
we'll chalk that up as a drafting error and drafting
we'll
the amendment.
We'll call that up as a drafting error, yes.
That does happen, Mr. Knopf, so we'll understand. So there will be at least one amendment likely for the Senate File 2227 when it's in full committee. And just so members know that.
Mr. Chair, one question.
Senator Osmick, please.
Before we leave 2067, we did an A1 amendment to that. Is it the assumption that A1 amendment is the proposed language?
Yes, that is.
Okay, yep. Thank you. That's all I need to clarify.
Yeah, it's 2067 as amended. So with that said, what I'm looking for is a motion to move language as currently amended in Senate File 2067, 2048, 2137, 2118, 2606, and 2531, that language to be amended into Senate File 2227.
As those bills were amended.
As all of those bills were amended, and just to be clear.
The one you read is 2018. I just want to make sure for the record.
Did I misspeak? I'm sorry. It's Senate File 2018. All of those Senate files as amended, we have a motion to amend those on to our Omnibus Bill 2227. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would actually recommend that we do these one at a time because I think you're going to hit one that you may not have consensus on.
I'd be happy to entertain that.
And I can speak to that. 26, Senator Mr.
Brown.
Chair. Senate File 2606, I'm not quite sure where my constituents on Lake Mille Lacs, but I need to ask the question, if that's amended into the bill today, is that something we can go back and attempt to take out later on?
Absolutely. What we're doing is we're building our omnibus bill here in committee, and that bill in all its parts could be considered for further amendment each step of the way forward. And I know this bill will be going to full committee next and then also to state and local government, we anticipate. So there will be two more stops before it hits the floor.
Okay. Actually finance
committee. And perhaps, yeah, that's right. I'm sorry, finance committee as well. So three more stops.
Can I go talk to
You sure can. So perhaps what we'll propose doing here is actually, if we don't mind, Senator Osmak, just for the sake of moving through the agenda here, if we were to separate 2606 out from the others and have one motion to adopt as amended, Senate File 2067, 2048, 2137, 2018, and 2531 as one motion, and then as a separate motion to adopt the language from 2606. Would that satisfy you?
I think I would be fine with that. Was there anyone here that wanted to speak to 2018 before we went forward?
2018 was a bill that was heard in committee
last
on Tuesday.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, if anybody would like to speak to any of the bills on the agenda today, you have not had an opportunity to do so, you know, please take the stand now. Otherwise, you know, I would, if it's okay with the committee, we can do this in two amendments here.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to bring to light there was an email. I received a constituent email on 2018. I think I can let it go forward on this one, and therefore I would make a motion to incorporate 2067 as amended, 2048, 2137, 2018, and 2531 into the omnibus bill.
And those are all, Mr. Chair, those would
Mr.
all be
Pinnock.
As amended.
As amended.
All
correct.
Senate files as amended. We have a motion. Do we have a second? I don't know if we need one, but Senator Osmak. But nonetheless, we're hammering home the point. All those in favor of Senator Osmak's motion,
aye.
Say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. And the amendment is adopted. And now, next, we have, I guess I'd entertain a motion for including Senate File 2606 to be amended onto Senate File 2227. Do I have a motion? Senator Eaton, would you like to move?
Oh, sure.
All right. Well, thank you, Senator Eaton. You've pinched that well today. All those in favor of amending 26. Senator Brown. Oh,
yeah, I just want to state if amending this on is going to open the door for more conversation, I really want to hear some more testifiers
sure.
on this.
Sure.
And if including this into the omnibus bill is going to do that, then I could support amending that on. But I just don't know from – I represent Lake Mille Lacs, and I don't know where they stand on this issue. I know where some of them stand, but I just need to hear more conversation on it before I could vote on the final bill. But if putting it into the omnibus bill is going to create a little more conversation, I could support that.
Senator Brown, I certainly respect that, and I would welcome that additional conversation moving forward.
Senator
Eden.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that I share your concern, and I have spoke with Mr. Senator Hoffman's LA, and I'm hoping that we can adjust the language a little more like the rulemaking process that the DNR is talking about, but I'd be more comfortable if that was law rather than rules.
Sure.
So that's my intention when we get to the next committee.
So my expectation is that when we go to full committee, we'll have an amendment to consider and also a discussion on this very point in that committee, and we'll move the bill forward as amended, potentially. So with that said, do I have a motion to amend 2227 with the language of 2606?
She already moved.
Okay, we do have that. All those in favor, aye?
Aye.
All those opposed, no?
No.
All right. And I'm an aye. So the motion carries, and 2606 is amended on to 2227. And with that said, members, this closes out the activity of the Game and Fish. We're going to move the bill. I'm sorry. We have a motion to move the bill on to full committee. Sorry, I am a rookie here. I appreciate you humoring me. But do you have a motion to move the bill?
Oh, sure.
All right. And the bill motion to move the bill onto the full Energy and Environment Committee, the bill as amended.
As
All
amended.
Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. All right. So moved. Thanks, folks.
So we'll get you
the lead
all, I think.
Sure.
Committee report, subcommittee report. That would be the best.
Okay. That was fine. And the meeting is adjourned.